Hello, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Barry and Carol for organizing this panel. I think a fitting way to end this, excuse me, is with a philosophy lecture. All right. other than that, I have nothing to disclose. So all of our speakers have given examples of the sample of crisis topics that comprises the perfect storm of Ebola's public health crisis. There are lots of stakeholders with many conflicting interests. You've got governments, you've got international organizations, healthcare organizations, health workers, patients in communities and affected areas, researchers, and media outlets. And there's loads of disagreement and cognitive dissonance about travel guidelines, obligations of health workers, obligations of well-resourced countries towards less-resourced countries, and information formats to allay public fears. Well, something that people have been talking about, and I want to echo this, is it's important to treat the fear of Ebola with a significant dose of reality. That involves managing risk and also public perception of risk. As we know, public perception of risk doesn't equal actual risk. Many people are afraid of Ebola when, in fact, what they should be getting is flu shots. Acting on perceived risks, though, has actual costs, which affects the resources for reducing the actual risk. So spending money on bad infrared thermometers is throwing good money after bad, for instance. But Ebola, for instance, poses real risks for health workers, but it poses perceived and much lower risks from health workers to the public. So, for instance, travel bans and quarantines of low-risk persons can impede the flow of resources and extend the outbreak. One thing we have learned from the new introduced cases of Ebola into well-resourced countries like Spain and the U.S. and other places is that when high-tech medicine meets Ebola, there are new special risks for health workers. For instance, we have the capacity to do invasive procedures like like intubation, dialysis, and CPR. Also, the PPE protocols are different, and they're different because there are structural differences in the details. It's really different standing in a ditch with gravel in West Africa, having somebody spray you with chlorine, than it is having somebody use chlorinated wipes to wipe down your PPE. People are paying attention to these detailed differences and the differences in the risk that they're going to present. Also, lower paid and more vulnerable health workers have less training, less input, and less autonomy over the scope of their jobs. That presents different risks as well. So what are some opportunities we have for learning about the relationships between technology and risk? Well, there are people who are engaging in ethical discussions about protocols. The Hastings Center has an interesting report out in which someone argues that Ebola patients should all be DNR. I'm not advocating this, but I'm saying that this is a discussion that some people are having, saying what kinds of risks should we subject healthcare workers to and under what circumstances? How does one run a code on an Ebola patient, for instance? Also, in the event, and we hope that this will happen, that expanded treatment options will present themselves in under-resourced countries, that will call for a focus on new protocols. There's ongoing research on PPE, infectious disease, and contamination. If I had all day, I would have put up this wonderful YouTube video. You should all Google Vomiting Larry, which is actually a report by a group out of England that's exploring the relationship between, well, projectile vomiting in the case of norovirus and ways to minimize contamination for healthcare workers using PPE. All right, so here's what the philosophers have to say. There's some guiding principles that many of you know about for dealing with public health emergencies. I'm just going to mention them here and then go through them in the slides. Reciprocity, solidarity, transparency, privacy, which has not been mentioned much at all in discussions, and proportionality. Let me go through these. reciprocity and the duty to care. What is reciprocity? This means acknowledging the risks and hardships that those who engage in fulfilling their duties to assist others take on, and this demands our respect, appreciation, and response in terms of compensation. Throughout the history of medicine, and one of our speakers spoke about this, plague, TB, HIV, SARS, health workers have put their health and lives on the line, and many of them have lost them. So, healthcare professional ethics codes often require and mandate taking kinds of risks. But if we want to take reciprocity into account, we should create environments with adequate safeguards, training, care, and compensation for workers who are exposed, ill, and quarantined. On to solidarity. Solidarity recognizes the importance of relationships, nation to nation, community to community, and person to person. It requires a shared commitment to taking on costs and burdens to assist others. So what are some ways we can put this into action? Well, increase and maintain global support for affected and under-resourced countries. And here's another one, another action plan that people have mentioned but hasn't gotten a lot of press. Come up with ways to combat stigma against health workers, Ebola survivors, and affected communities. Transparency and privacy. Transparency is all about openness and freedom of discussion for decision making, in which stakeholders all have a voice. They have a seat at the table. So this has been happening, but this needs to be maintained, in which we create and maintain open lines of discussion about different kinds of procedures, from any travel restrictions to quarantines to infection reduction plans. Also, transparency includes disseminating this information to all affected groups in modes they can understand and take in. Privacy. Privacy is a guiding principle that requires respecting individual rights and control over personal information. There was lots of talk on the public health ethics blogs and public health ethics Facebook page. By the way, I'm putting a plug in for that. It's a really good source of public health ethics information. So people from public health ethicists from other countries couldn't understand why we weren't all up in arms about the fact that Thomas Duncan's name was all over the press, not to mention the name of the doctor in New York who contracted Ebola. So we need to put rules in place to protect information about health workers and patients. Of course, this has to be balanced with the need for transparency in protecting the public from risk of exposure. But what I'm suggesting is privacy needs to be in the mix. Finally, proportionality. Proportionality requires a response reflecting the least intrusive or least coercive means for achieving public health goals. So, in devising rules for reducing risk to the public, say from returning health workers, we want plans which are scientifically based, which are transparent, least intrusive or coercive, clearly disseminated and implemented, and also reflect the values of reciprocity and solidarity. Some of these principles are being held in mind by policymakers, but as public health workers and public health policy people and researchers, clinicians, and providers, I think it's up to us to make sure that these principles are given voice. Thank you very much.
We're now going to have a question and answer period of about 15 minutes. I realize some of you may need to leave, but I'm going to ask all of our speakers to come up here if they would. There's a microphone in the middle of the room. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, please come up to the microphone. Are there any comments or questions? Please. Thank you. Thank you, Kumar. First question, please.
Yes, I have three quick questions. They're actually about the specifics of Ebola. The first is, I observed on one of the slides that 14% of the patients in one of the locations did not present with fever. And I want to know what are the implications for how we're talking about Ebola here in terms of a symptom?
Yeah, let's take those one at a time. Does anyone want to comment on that? The fact that 14% do not present with fever?
I saw that on maybe two presentations back. It was a thing where you were talking about the symptoms.
Okay. Dr. Idris, please.
What we did simply was to go through the case notes to see how each one of them presented, what kind of symptoms they presented, and now they analyzed 70% of them presented with fever. But again, I think it's a matter of when they were caught or when they came into the observation. They might have had fever before then, but after that they presented these were the symptoms they had. I tell you again, the case that left Lagos to Port Harcourt, how Port Harcourt was infected, the guy was being followed up, he never had fever. Then he stopped taking up his phone answering his calls. They got to Port Harcourt, we didn't know that he had fever and developed symptoms. He was bedridden, was hospitalized. But again, I tell you, came to do this again, it was symptoms free. So
the reason I asked this is that I heard the deputy director of the division at CDC, who is over Ebola, say, and I remember the 16% of people in the current epidemic never have fever, and I'm just, that's a tremendous thing if that's true, and I actually saw it reflected on somebody's slide. If that's true, then the way we're talking about fever as a presenting symptom needs to be interrogated. So we don't have to go on anymore. I was just wondering, but I did see that reflected on a slide again in terms of symptoms.
Sure. Second question.
Second question is, I understand that Ebola, after a patient is free of the virus in their blood, that Ebola stays in the semen for 3 months. I want to hear if that's true, and if so, what are we doing to prevent the sexual transmission of Ebola?
Dr. Harcourt, I see you're nodding. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, just a quick thing. I understand the concern about fever, some people not presenting with fever. The reality, though, is a little bit different from what those figures would suggest. First of all, there's a difference between what people initially present with and what shortly develops after. So a large number of the studies I've read is 12%, but it's in the same ballpark. People will present fever shortly after. The other thing is a large portion of the others have other symptoms. So, and people in West Africa know this. So if you say, if you've been exposed and you're tired and you have a headache, that's a warning sign, and people know this enough that can be used. There's an algorithm for Ebola that is not entirely dependent on fever that will take care of a lot of this. So it's true. I mean, I've read, it's not like I did the studies myself, but that it can be transmitted. There's one case that I've heard of somebody infecting his partner, 3 months after being sick. That's widely known, and people are, it's being circulated, and most survivors, at least the ones that are treated in units, are being told that information. Whether more could be done, sure, but the reality is this is not the major route of transmission.
I know, it'd be good that we could worry about it with enough survivors.
And
the third question is about, I understand the use of convalescent serum is very promising. I was wondering, because bats are the reservoir from which this came, are people looking also at why bats are not affected by the disease?
Yeah, and just to clarify, bats are presumed but not known.
Okay.
Yes. Anyone want to comment on that as to why bats don't get sick, presumably?
Again, I haven't done extensive veterinary studies myself on bats, but what I've read is that bats are actually reservoirs of a large number of diseases because they are similar enough in being mammalian that the diseases, can survive in bats as they can in humans. But they're different enough, and there's a difference in terms of their immune system that they tend not to be killed. So I don't know the exact mechanistic reason, but it's apparently not particular to Ebola. So next time you see a bat, I would say, well,
right, it's something we might be able to exploit.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. First of all, let me commend our speakers for the update on Ebola. I'm from Sierra Leone, and obviously, I work for the U.S. Public Health Service, and I've been very much engaged with the diaspora of those affected communities. One of the things, one of the challenges that we've seen in the U.S. strategies, response of perhaps NGOs and intervention has been the reluctance of engaging diasporas that have the requisite knowledge, that are competent and have the cultural competence to be engaged with U.S. strategies. And that, to me, is a big missed opportunity. And my question then is, why is it there so much resistance and reluctance of all our players, international players, to engage diaspora, knowing that diaspora have direct links with their local communities, which perhaps might help to quell some of these fears that we start seeing in our responses?
Who would like to respond?
My question would be turned around. I'm also very, very involved with the diaspora of Sierra Leone, and I sense a high level of fear in the diaspora. There are a lot of doctors and nurses in the diaspora that I think should and could be going back to Sierra Leone to help, because they have those underlying cultural understandings that would really help. I don't think the death of Dr. Salia this morning is going to help that a whole lot. I think that the fear levels are astronomical, and it's difficult to take those risks and go back. So I don't know. I have the same question. I don't have an answer. I just have questions.
Thank you. Next question.
If I can just come in quickly on that, one of the first of all, it'd be good to contact us and the various organizations here to offer your services. I think we're all looking for people to get involved. But when as we were preparing this report we did on Liberia, one of the most enlightening conversations we had with our mail and with our incoming and shipping mail and shipping clerk in the IRC office in New York, who happens to be from Liberia, and we've known him for years. It's the man who delivers the mail. But in Liberia, who was a union leader, and he's still a big leader of his community, and the insights he gave us into what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong about our response was just phenomenal, and I would say one of the most helpful things that anyone's told me about how to do the response. So I think there are a lot of things that the diaspora can do without necessarily even traveling back to their country, just by informing the people who are going out there.
Thank you. Yes.
Hi, my name is Diana, and I'm a volunteer with a very small organization called Mali Health, and they are actually one of the epicenters for the Ebola outbreak in Mali, and I'm trying to help them network with other public health professionals working in Mali at this conference. So I'm going to go stand over here. If anybody that is working in Mali, Mali Health has a clinic in Chikoroni, which is right outside the capital of Bamako. They have an amazing infrastructure of community health workers. They have a lot of trust in the community. They don't have resources, and they're looking to gain more contacts. And I have handouts. So I'm going to stand over here, and thank you. And I'd like to commend the speakers as well.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. My question is to the last speaker, and I wonder, within the context of health professionals, are we still so terrified by the slow response to AIDS that we are so overly scary regarding Ebola? What's your view? Thank you.
Yes. Yes, I think that's so, and it's interesting to me that we keep playing out the same story over and over again. I've written a little bit about this for Popular Press this fall, and there's a New England Journal of Medicine article about dealing with fear and panic and protecting healthcare workers about HIV. This is from 1990. There's some great work done by public health ethicists out of Toronto on lessons about SARS. So we keep telling the same stories over and over again. And what this means is we're not very good at managing fear of risk. Everybody in philosophy of medicine, philosophy of public health, and public health professionals knows this. It's an ongoing set of needs for increased communication.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sarah McKeon, and I have I'm at the College of Public Health at the University of Florida, and I have a comment and a question. My comment is that we've been analyzing WHO data coming out of Liberia in real time, and I think it's really important that everybody in the room put pressure, as it is appropriate on the institutions to get information out, because we're getting a lot of pushback, whether it's from peer-reviewed journal articles that it takes more time or whatever, and from WHO, using WHO to get data and get it published by the government of Liberia, by the government of Sierra Leone, so putting pressure to get information out. I'm working with anthropologists who have a lot of, you know, decades of experience, like we're talking about, people who know the context, getting that information out so it can be uptaken quickly and put into use. My question is specifically about gender. So I work on a lot of different issues in inequity, and the second article that we have out, attempted for publication right now, is really underscoring the gender dynamics of the of transmission and how women are, not surprisingly, at heightened risk for morbidity and mortality because of their role as caregivers, particularly in Liberia. And I'm just wondering whether the response effort, be it in treatment or prevention, if anybody is looking at a really gendered approach to how we do this, to look at the vulnerability of women. Thank you.
Our organization is specifically focused on women to start with, and Ebola response and disaster relief is not our typical MO, but everybody in the region, I think, is doing something different than what they typically do right now. And so our focus is really educating women, and you're right, it's like 70% women that are contracting the virus and dying from it. I think on the issue of information, it's a lot more complicated than you might think to get that information out as quickly as possible. You know, sometimes you see these like dips in numbers and then surges, and it's like, oh, it's going away, oh, it's coming back. It's just backlogs of lab tests. It's not new cases. It's just backlogs of lab tests. They're sitting there waiting to be taken care of. And like I mentioned in the story, the lab tests, like in our area, there is no lab in our area, so it takes almost a week for people to get their lab tests sent out and come back. And that's a real big problem in just trying to contain the virus itself. So there's a whole lot of complicated factors on the field that are influencing what kind of data we have available even.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes, I'm a physician, and I've been following the news media about Ebola since its inception, the last summer, I think, when they started talking about it. And I'd heard of Ebola, and I knew how it was transmitted. And it's interesting, I'm trying to figure out why it is that the response of international organizations such as the World Health Organization were so slow. I don't know, I remember hearing Margaret Chan speaking some months ago saying that they would just give some money to these countries and have their health workers take care of it, everything would be fine. That's paraphrasing, but you know, it seems to me that it was a statement made by, I think, a doctor from Paul Farmer's group that went down there and volunteered recent months and saw the situation in the Seoul response. She called it a racist situation. I tend to agree, but I'm just wondering why it is there was no, given what we know about how it's transmitted and how it can be, it fizzled out in Congo because the isolated areas where it died off, and as was pointed out, one of the talks, they burned the huts down, and it didn't go on to other places. But we know how congested these cities are in Liberia and Sierra Leone. Why is it that kind of, it wasn't rocket science, why did these international organizations not respond quickly enough, even though it was warnings given by Doctors Without Borders and other groups? I'm wondering why that didn't happen much earlier.
Yes.
It's scary to me.
I think we have to be really careful about easy stories. And frankly, I mean, believe me, we work a lot with WHO and okay. I'm banging my head many times in frustration, but they have their flaws and they have their strengths. And I don't think it's fair, accurate to pin most of the blame. What they have been is sort of pretty disastrous about communication, and that's what we're seeing. But, you know, just to say, and not to lay blame on anyone, we all have things we could have done a lot better, but MSF was actually in charge of the outbreak initially, and they declared it over. And they completely missed the fact that in Guinea, a lot of people did not trust the government. So there was a disconnect, and part of this is linked to the fact that during the war, MSF had dealings with the combatants. And MSF, and they talk about this quite openly, say that they had to, because they it was the only way to get some stuff done and to get access. But we know for a fact, and I know because I spoke to a number of Liberians about this, people were eminently aware of this. And so there was a trust issue with MSF as well. But MSF's been a past master at talking about it, and I think there's an anthropologist who calls it ethical self-fashioning. And I don't really blame MSF for that. You know, they're doctors, they've actively promoted a treatment model, which isn't really the heart of the issue with this epidemic, because they're mostly doctors and they focus on giving high-quality care in developing countries. But I think the media, frankly, for my money, deserves a lot more scrutiny than it's gotten compared to WHO, which deserves scrutiny and has gotten that scrutiny. Because the how this was presented has a big way, you know, a lot to do with how people didn't respond. So I would really be very careful about just piling on and having the good guys and the bad guys, because the fact is that reality is a lot more complicated.
I would just say one thing, just to reinforce the fact that I think, you know, just as we learned a lot of issues in Texas and the U.S., I think the WHO has learned a lot as well. I would go back to the communication comment, but I think as we tried to figure out where were the right volunteer groups, where were the places that Americans should be sending money, there was about a 60-day hiatus where you really couldn't get very clear information going back early in the summer, and so I think that lag also probably contributed.
I see five people standing in line. We'll take five more questions. Please be brief.
Actually, one very pointed question.
Yes.
About Nigeria. You mentioned the large number of ethnic groups in Nigeria. And first of all, congratulations on containing the epidemic there, and hopefully that will continue. But are the burial practices among those ethnic groups, or most of those ethnic groups in Nigeria, are they similar to ones in Guinea and Liberia that were part of the issue, or were the practices themselves somewhat protective? And the second is more of a comment. It was my understanding, Emmanuel and others, that the WHO had, for financial reasons, had closed or certainly shrank their hemorrhagic fever department that they had at one time. They had a department that dealt with viral hemorrhagic fevers, and I had heard through the press that was either discontinued or certainly scaled down due to lack of funding. So I would like to see if I can get some the fact on that one and the other, just about the practices in Nigeria. Thank you.
The burial practices are basically the same. Some groups of people, different parts of Nigeria, had this funny thing. Your loved ones died. Specifically, the bodies are kept. Some people can keep these bodies for 24 to 48 hours. People perform different rituals, drinking from sources from these bodies. And these are the things we try to stop. If you recollect from what we gathered again, something similar happened in Guinea and that kind of thing. And that's why we decided to focus on mug operators, people, and telling what to do with cases. In fact, as a matter of fact, we stopped people transporting bodies for burial across the state without taking extra permission from government, either Lagos State government or Nigerian government. We had to call the mug operators and teaching them again how to address all these bodies. They were not just to treat them, just anyhow. So the burial practices are basically the same. Some people sit down there. In fact, you can have the spouse of a man who died kept in a particular room for a while. It's part of the thing that he had to hold on to his body, do all sorts of rituals, and do that he wanted to prevent. And that's why we went about to publicize that.
Time for four more questions. Please keep it very short.
Very quickly, thank you all. Just in the Healthy Work Environment Guidelines that Dr. Cipriano spoke to, I just wanted to comment on the statement about the nurse's right to refuse. That's a negative protection. My inquiry doesn't have to be answered today, but I wanted to raise it, is our primary duty is really to patients, and we know that. And I just would like to mention that it is something that can be turned into a positive guideline, rather than such an influential organization putting out such a negative message that you can walk away from a situation rather than maybe talk to your colleagues or frame it a little bit different. Thank you.
Dr. Cipriano, do you want to respond to that or not particularly?
I'd be happy to catch her afterwards, yeah. There is a broader context.
Next question, please.
Hi, great panel. My name is Umair Shah. I'm the County Health Department Director at Harris County Public Health Environmental Services and County Health Department in Houston, Texas. And I just want to applaud you again for your fantastic concert. We're just south of Dallas, and the last 6-7 weeks has really set our department back 3-4 months, because all we've been doing is Ebola. We're response and readiness and activities and really losing some of the nuances of all the other messaging that's out there around Ebola. I just wanted to ask the very general question. The comment we've been making to folks is that the only way we're going to be able to get to theoretical risk zero in our community is if we contain the outbreak overseas. If that message is very challenging to get across, can you help us a little bit with trying to hone down that message and get that articulated to our communities? Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone want to comment on that? Comment on the comment? No? We'll go on to the next question. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for your awesome presentations. In our efforts to encourage fact over fears, I'm just concerned, or I guess my question is about the transmission of it. I know that it's a daily development and we're learning more and more every day, but it's, for me, the message is mixed as how it's really transmitted, because we're talking about the burial process. It makes me think that, you know, it could just be transmitted through the sweat glands if you, you know, touch, or if it's viral, you know, like, is it airborne? So that's basically my question. If we could have clarity on exactly how it's transmitted. Thank you.
Great. Any comments on that?
Can I just...
Yeah, please.
As a non-scientist in the group, but who reads a lot of articles, there's an awful lot of really good sort of general articles written by virologists. So all you have to do is Google something. There's one by a virologist who works in a level 4 biocontainment lab. She did it while she was pregnant. She did a big interview to talk about the ways that you can and can't catch Ebola. I don't think there are any cases of transmission through sweat glands to intact skin, but there's a recent article in JAMA about this. They're still working on it, but there's a lot of good information on this. Understandable to the public out there.
Thank you. Last question, please.
My question was sort of observation, being that area was a large slave trade area, and, you know, seeing that if that affected the apathy, you know, people wanting to go into that area, being that a lot of African Americans went back to that area and other colonies, how does that affect that?
You want to comment on that? The fact that it had been a slave trade area and African Americans going back there, is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, anyone want to comment?
I mean, it's a huge issue. We could have a whole panel just on the history, both the recent and the older one. But what people say is that, you know, there was a divide for about 100 years after its founding. Liberia was ruled by people who had come from the U.S. and basically replicated the same oppressive culture or situation that they had come from, but except that they were the masters rather than the slaves. And that was, you know, the turmoil of the last 25 years in Liberia was linked, or 30 years really, was linked reportedly to that, in the sense that there was people who were what they call indigenous, who were fighting against what they perceive as the elite. But I think that, you know, that people more qualified than me, there's great stuff on the internet about that. I think it's also important to consider, though, that even with the complexity of these histories, individuals are even more complex than that. And I find the situation in terms of who's getting the job done, who's not, in Liberia itself, you can't really pin it down to that simple division.
Well, the only reason I said that is because he said that most of the cases, the majority of the cases were located in a certain area, and it seemed like they was like, okay, it's just that area, it's not the rest of the, you know, the country in that part. We don't care about that area.
Yeah.
Lost those people. I'm not trying to point fingers.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you all for your questions. I want to remind you that the IRC report, just one second, Different Kind of Army, a call to place community leadership at the center of the Ebola response, is available here also at rescue.org. Let's thank all our speakers.